You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 118.
On today's show, we talk about our recent visit to Chichen Itza.
Let's dig a little deeper. All right, welcome to the Archaeology Show. How's it going?
Good.
So we got to preface this by saying we're in a different recording location. As longtime listeners know, we live in an RV, and we're currently in Pennsylvania as we're recording this, and I'm meeting with a client in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
So we decided to, instead of just come out here, which is about an hour and a half drive from where we're parked with our RV, instead of just coming out here for the morning and meeting with this client on a Friday, we would come and just spend the day Friday and Saturday, exploring the history and the sites of Philadelphia. So maybe we'll have that to talk about on a future episode.
Yeah, that would be awesome, because cool. I didn't really know a whole lot about this area, and I am excited to learn and explore it.
Yeah. So we're in a hotel room kind of Airbnb thing. If you don't know about Sonder, check it out. They seem to have some pretty cool places. Anyway,
it's like a little apartment.
Yeah.
It's cute and small.
Yeah, and we had a smaller one, actually, that probably wouldn't be so echoey with hardwood floors, actually booked. But 2 hours before we got here, they called and said the previous occupant utterly destroyed the room.
I'm like, what does that mean? Yeah. Like, what is utterly? They must have had a party and just like broke furniture and stuff or something.
Yeah, they did something. And clearly the cleaning staff didn't get there in time to take care of it. So they said, we're moving you. And they moved us to a one bedroom down the street. So a much more expensive place for the same price. I'm like, yes, please.
Yeah. Sounds good to us.
But there's like construction outside.
Yeah.
And there's all kinds of things going. I mean, we're in a city, so you're going to hear some noise.
Yeah.
And I'm going to try to cut some of this reverb out, but it is what it is.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's going to be kind of the name of the game with us, is that we will be recording in different places all the time. And that's just,
right.
That's better just than our lifestyle right now.
Better than our last recording on that GoPro with the wind.
Yeah,
and
that
and
was
Cancun.
Really bad.
Yeah. So anyway, this is top notch compared to that. If I'd remembered my microphones in Mexico,
in Cancun,
that would have been better.
Been fine.
So.
Yeah.
Speaking of,
yes,
we were in Mexico a couple weeks ago.
We were.
Yeah. And we mentioned we'd be doing a Chichen Itza episode. And I think we talked about on that show why we felt relatively okay going to Mexico during a pandemic or the later throes of a pandemic, depending on where you're sitting on this.
And also the reason we feel okay being here in Philadelphia is we are both vaccinated. Number one, we were able to get in on some overflow vaccines that were going to be thrown away. Because neither of us technically we do qualify now, but at the time we didn't. So
yeah.
Anyway, we got in on an overflow vaccine situation and we got vaccinated.
Vaccinated.
Vaccinated. I am smart. S-M-R-T. Anyway, so we're both vaccinated and we've both been very good about just staying away from people. We did it in Mexico. We kept our masks on the whole time we were there, even though other people were not doing that, with the exception of when we were in the water. And we just made an effort to stay isolated as well as we could. So I think we've been doing a pretty good job. And we're doing the same thing here in Philadelphia as well.
Yeah, I mentioned meeting with a client, but all of their people, because it's a public institution, they're all vaccinated.
Yeah.
And
you have to get a rapid test too when you arrive, don't you?
I have to get a test coming in the door that they'll have the results for in 15 minutes. So That's kind of crazy.
Yeah, but it's good. It's
all of us do.
Keeping everybody protected, and it's just another one of the things that makes us feel like we're okay, and hopefully not contributing to the furthering of the pandemic, because I think we're relatively safe right now. So,
right.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the Maya.
Yeah, let's do that. So this whole episode is prompted by our time in Mexico, of course, and when we were going there, we knew we wanted to leave the resort and do some archaeology stuff. In pre-pandemic times, we had bigger plans of like meeting up with some people that you knew through somebody else who could get us like, almost like a special tour of the area, right?
Right.
But then, pandemic happened. We had to cancel our plans. And this time around, we just knew we wouldn't be able to coordinate that. So we just sort of booked a tour through our resort and just sort of went with it, because we're like, well, we'll see some ruins, we'll see the temples, And that's really the best we can hope for, right?
Yeah, and there were other tours available. In fact, we were closer to Tulum, which is a big Mayan ruins right on the sea, which would have been really cool. But, you know, if you've only got a limited amount of time, and if we'd have done everything, sure, we'd paid for our all-inclusive resort thing a long time ago, so that was like already done. Mm-hmm. But all these extra little things cost a lot of money. It's not cheap to do these tours.
They do. I think we paid like maybe $200 total for this Chichen Itza tour round trip, and that was like a full day thing. We'll get into that a little bit more in the next segment because what we wanted to do, here's what we should have done before we went to Chichen Itza. We should have done a little bit of research to figure out exactly what we were going to see and just get a better idea of the people that built it and what the civilization was like there, because that I felt was very much missing from the tour.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they talked about the Mayan calendar and how it was supposed to end in 2012, and they talked about the serpent on the steps that happens because of the shadow across the pyramid and, you know, all the things that it is technically famous for, but it's not really the like archaeology and civilization focused things. And I feel like we missed that a little bit on the tour.
I feel like the stuff that we learned are the things that are contained in like the base knowledge that most archaeologists have of Chichen Itza.
Yeah.
Whether you remember it or not, we all learned about Chichen Itza at some point during our education.
Right.
And it not necessarily your like high school education, but definitely an undergraduate education. Mm-hmm. It was always in like an anthropology 101 class. And, you know, Rachel and I came through undergrad at basically the same time, separated by like 10 years in age. But, you know, I went into the Navy first and served my country, whatever. NBD. Anyway, so.
Oh, privileged white girl over here. Sorry.
Anyway, so we did. We basically were in college at the beginning of the 2000s, you know, kind of at the same time in different places. And that's also when Jared Diamond's book came out called, was it just called Collapse? He had a book called Collapse because it was right after Guns, Germs, and Steel, which was huge. And Collapse came out like right after that. And I actually was in a little reading group in college that talked about Collapse. And I don't know if you ever read that, but a lot of people were reading that. And it was polarizing because the Maya were in there as the Maya, Easter Island. I think Rome was in there, but it was the collapse of civilizations. What causes it? What happens? And of course the initial blowback was, well, I mean, there's still Maya that live there.
Yeah.
Like our guide was Mayan.
Yeah.
According to him.
Yeah.
You know, he's a descendant. There's current Mayan people. We went to a Mayan village.
Yeah.
And bought things from them.
There's thousands of Mayan people that still live in the area, and they still lived in that area when the Spanish conquistador showed up. So like, yes, the city doesn't exist as it did, you know, 1,000 years ago anymore, but that doesn't mean the people are gone.
Yeah. I mean, because they're not living in big stone, around big stone temples and doing that and beheading people every Sunday. Does that mean that they collapsed? They just changed what they're doing.
Yeah. Well, I firmly believe we need to take back the word collapse because you can still talk about a city collapsing and no longer being the same center of power that it was without indicating that the people also disappeared.
I mean, let's talk about the collapse of Tonopah, Nevada. That's something nobody wants to talk about.
There's still people there.
Listen, the silver industry itself in Tonopah, Nevada in 1905 was raging. Yeah. And then it collapsed.
How about Virginia City? That's an even better example.
The collapse of Virginia City. Now it's just a tour spot, just like Chichen Itza.
Sure, there's like thousands of people there. And there's probably people there that have lived there their whole lives. But
I'm so going to write a book about the collapse of Tonopah.
You absolutely should. All right, so moving on. So here's what we should have done before we went to Chichen Itza. And anybody who has plans on going to see it, and if they're doing it as part of a resort tour, I would recommend doing a little bit of research ahead of time just so that you know who the Maya are and why they were in Chichen Itza specifically.
Mm-hmm.
So starting with who they are and where they are, they sort of spread across southeastern Mexico, Guatemala, Belize, and then the western parts of Honduras and El Salvador. So really large area that they occupied. And most of the major part of their society was in the Guatemala area. That seems to be where the major complex civilizations were. Mm-hmm. With Chichen Itza excluded, of course, because that's in Mexico. But
yeah, and that is one thing that our guide said about Chichen Itza was that it was more of a mixture of societies that came there and used that as a religious and temple space. So
yeah,
and we'll talk about that in the next segment more.
That was one thing that he didn't get entirely wrong. So yeah.
So, but this massive spread across all these different regions with these probably smaller tribes and things like that is one thing that probably contributed to that.
Yeah, for sure. So Mayan civilization is broken up into really annoying archaeology terms like they always are. So we start with the pre-classic period.
I feel like, what was it? It was some sitcom or something where somebody was making fun of terms like that. And I feel like everything is like, all right, we're going to talk about the proto pre post classic period now.
Yeah, exactly. Like, come on, do better. But anyway, so the pre-classic period dates from about 2000 BCE to 250 CE. It's a large time period, and it's when these large complex societies just, they began building them. They started doing things like cultivating the staple crops like maize, beans, squash varieties, chili peppers. All those things started to happen, and it's what allowed these complex societies to develop.
Yeah, and let's talk about BCE and CE real quick.
Yeah.
Because I don't know if we ever have. BCE stands for Before the Common Era. And CE stands for Common Era, and it was probably developed in order to basically take Jesus out of it.
Yeah, like because, to de-Christianify dating.
Yeah, because BC, pre this, is before Christ, and AD is Anno Domini, after death.
Yeah.
So they say BCE and CE, and yet still base it on Christ.
I know, we really should just be doing
BP.
Yeah, before present.
Yeah, but most archaeologists and scientists that are doing anything date related, when they put dates in papers,
it's BP.
They'll say Cal BP usually, which is calibrated. Before present, calibrated, or calibrated years, or calibrated, you know, whatever it is. And calibrated means it was, you've got some sort of date that was calibrated against something else.
Okay.
You know, like carbon 14 dating is often calibrated against tree ring dating or some other sort of dating method. So it's placed in time. So, but BCE and CE are what's in a lot of the literature. So just know that before Common Era is before 2000, CE is, I mean, before zero and after CE is after zero. But if you ever hear BP, it's literally before present. Also, interestingly, carbon 14 dates, when you hear BP, it typically refers to before like the 1950s.
Oh.
Because the 1950s and 40s and 50s is when we did a lot of nuclear testing.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually blew the carbon 14 ratio out of whack for everything going forward.
Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
well, there you go.
So anybody trying to do carbon 14 dating like 1,000 years from now for this time period is not going to be very successful. So, but anything,
sorry, future archaeologists.
I know anything before that has its ratio locked in typically in the carbon deposits and you can measure that ratio, but anything after that has an inflated amount in it that's unnatural.
Gotcha. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, moving forward. Yeah. That's your definition of the times and how that works. So in this pre-classic period, the large cities began to emerge by about 500 BCE. And these are the cities that had monumental architecture. They're large, complex, probably dynasty type of societies. And they were mostly in the Guatemala Highlands. So this developed into what is called the Classic Period. And that begins in 250 CE. And the reasons I saw for starting this period at that time is because it's when they started using the Maya long count calendar. And what I mean by long count calendar is that they identified a date in the past, like I think it was like 3,000 years ago or something like that. And they started counting time based on that specific date. And you know how I don't really know exactly how the Mayan calendar works, but it is how they counted time and they based everything in their lives around this calendar.
Yeah, I'd like to bring in an expert on the Mayan calendar because the long count, I believe, is loosely based on, and I don't know how the Maya ever would have known this, but loosely based on like the solar system's trip around the galaxy.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah. Not necessarily exactly. And I think it's more than 3,000 years. It's like 25,000 years or something like that.
Oh, maybe. Yeah. I didn't really look into it in detail, but yeah.
But it's almost like this calendar. I mean, they have an enormous number of gods, of course, like a lot of societies around this time did. But it almost seems like the calendar became like their guiding religion. Mm-hmm. You know, everything was just built around it, and you know, everything just was based around the calendar.
So. All the structures, all the temples, everything. It had some significance with the calendar, as you know, as the inspiration for what they were doing. So it was very, very important to them as a society.
Yeah, I feel like if you went back there and talked to us, because the probably the Mayan priests and stuff were the ones that were really involved with all that. And I feel like if you went back as a mathematician and just said, sat them down and showed them like algebra, they'd be just like amazed.
Oh, yeah, probably.
They probably already got things like algebra. They just called it something different.
They probably did. Yeah. And they probably would have developed it on their own given enough time.
Yeah. Yeah. If they hadn't collapsed.
There's that word again. Mayan people are gone. They're not.
It just goes to show you, if you don't learn algebra, you will collapse.
Oh, my God. So moving on. There were a bunch of these different city-states that had monumental architecture, and they were based on this calendar, and they were all linked by like really complex trade systems across Guatemala and then Belize and into the other countries I mentioned. And they were definitely dynastic societies that had one single leader. And then by the 800s, this time period is coming to a close, and it's partly because there's a rise of like a rich upper class from all this trading that they were doing. And they started sort of eroding the power of the one single king that had been ruling the whatever society it was. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple in particular that were like the major cities in Guatemala. Their names are escaping me right now, but they both just sort of, that power started to diversify, and it wasn't with one person and one family. And they just sort of like lost power, and eventually the cities themselves just kind of broke down, and all the people that were there didn't go anywhere. They did not collapse along with the city. They moved north, it seems like. And that's how we ended up seeing the rise of Chichen Itza in the northern part, in the post-classic part, if you will.
It's the post-new proto-classic. Something or other.
The post-classic era, which begins around the 800s, and Chichen Itza is the sort of center of power of that time period, and it's these people who were in Guatemala, and they sort of started moving north and creating this power. And it's why you see such a diverse population and diverse types of architecture in Chichen Itza, is because it's a bunch of people sort of coming into this area together, like migrating there together.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, and the Maya were still there when the conquistador showed up. There's a city called Nojpeten.
Spell it.
Nojpeten.
I'm not going to try to pronounce a Mayan word.
Yeah, I can't do that. But it was the last, you know, uncolonized Mayan city, and it didn't fall is not quite the right word, obviously, because the Mayan people are still around. But the Spanish didn't sort of get them in line, if you will, until the end of the 1600s. So, you know, Mayans were there for a long time, and they're still there. So.
All right. Well, with that, we'll talk about our visit to Chichen Itza on the other side of the break. Back in a minute. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Register of Professional Archaeologists and the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's paleoimaging.com, and check out the link in the show notes. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 118, and we are talking about the Maya civilization and our visit to Chichen Itza, one of the most well-known Mayan, sites, architecture, things. It's temples, on calendars and mouse pads. Chichen Itza is everywhere.
It's very identifiable.
Yeah. And, you know, I knew that Chichen Itza was made in, you know, the last couple thousand years. I didn't exactly know when.
Mm-hmm.
But knowing that it's only about, in the context of, you know, monumental architecture from civilizations we know well, it's only like 1200 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it practically looks brand new when you go there, I got to say, compared to other things.
So actually that's interesting you say that, because you should see some of the pictures from the 1800s. It is well documented by like your early gentleman archaeologists in the 1800s, because there's tons of photographs and like the whole thing is covered in vegetation, like fully covered in vegetation. It looks like a steppe period green mountain. So to give you a little bit of background here, Chichen Itza is in the state of Yucatan in Mexico, and it's a large pre-Hispanic city. It was occupied from the late classic period to the early post-classic period. There we go again with those oh my dates. God. And it sort of started rising to power in around 600, and it had really established itself as like the new sort of regional center. And, you know, by the 800s, and that's why people started moving there when the other cities were sort of falling apart further south. And then it was occupied consistently, we know for sure, until the 1100s. But I did read that when the conquistadors arrived, there were people living in the area. Now, whether they were occupying the actual structures there in and around the temple itself is unclear, or if it was just a nearby settlement. However, there were definitely people in the area, and it's, I think, reasonable to assume that they were still using the temple for whatever purposes that particular group of people at that time wanted to use it for.
Yeah, I mean, let's not forget that people are people, right?
Yeah. Now,
they may have a local knowledge and lore of the area as a religious center and may fear some areas or have respect for some areas. Mm-hmm. Because of that, it's like, you know, before Notre Dame burned down, if we were in France, I'm not Catholic. I wasn't there when it was built. I don't know anything, but I know enough to know that this is a massive religious center for a large group of people and, you know, respect it when you go by. Mm-hmm. If that whole area had been abandoned and that cathedral was still sitting there, it's not like we'd turn it into a coffee shop. Well, we might, but, you know, maybe a library or something.
I mean, it probably would still be in use, especially in a place like this, yeah, where it's not like those huge monumental structures were everywhere on the landscape.
Right.
You know, this one was pretty significant and unique. So
yeah,
if there were indigenous people living in that area, I'm sure that they were doing something with the temple. So, but it is unclear with the accounts of the times of the people that were there.
Yeah, I would say probably one of two things would keep people from living in these already built structures, because living is hard, right? Mm-hmm. So why wouldn't you live in these structures or around these structures and continue to use them, even though the center of power may have collapsed and nobody's really running it anymore? But one of the two reasons would be A, that religious reference, knowing mm-hmm. that, hey, this is something important from the past. I probably shouldn't be here. It's kind of like bad juju. I don't want to do it.
Yeah.
You know, lots of crazy things happen here. And also, you know, if people do leave for a little while, it doesn't take the jungle long to come back.
Oh, for sure.
And it would take a long time and a lot of maintenance to keep it beaten back. And if you don't yeah. have a, you know, a group and staff of people keeping up on that, the jungle's just going to take over.
I'm telling you, we'll have to put a photo in the show notes, but like furry green steppe pyramids, that's what they look like yeah. in the pictures yeah. from the 1800s. It's crazy.
Well, and that's why it's been so hard to find stuff down in the Yucatan and just like Mexico and Central America that are, you know, these huge cities basically mm-hmm. and people just wandered up and like bumped into them basically
yeah.
because they didn't even know they were there. And that's why things like LIDAR, light detection and ranging, it's, you know, usually aircraft mounted machine that can basically see through vegetation essentially by the way that it bounces light around, and it can discern shapes beneath the vegetation that you wouldn't normally see.
Right, right.
Shapes in the landform. And also, of course, rock is basically landform that we have altered. So mm-hmm. Shapes like that. And that's how you can see some of this stuff. And a lot of people have found whole things like this mm-hmm. just from doing LIDAR surveys.
So, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, as far as like the early excavations at Chichen Itza.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, Americans have their hands in things, as we do. Yeah. And there was an American ambassador to the Yucatan state specifically. His name was Edward Herbert Thompson in the 1800s. And he actually purchased Chichen Itza and all of the land around it sometime in the late 1800s.
Yeah, who did he buy that from?
Unclear. I don't know.
Like, who had the authority to sell it?
I don't know. It's actually interesting you say that because he did that. He excavated a lot of the temple area and a lot of the outlying buildings. He did a lot of excavation. Don't know how well those excavations were done. I didn't deep dive that. And the other thing he did was in the 1900s, like the early 1900s, he dredged the cenote, the main cenote there. So Cenote Sagrado is the big cenote, the biggest cenote on the property. And Edward Herbert Thompson dredged it to see what kind of artifacts he could find in it. And he did. He found like some jade stuff and some obsidian and a bunch of things, and also human remains. And the Mexican government made a claim at one point that he stole all those artifacts that he found. And I guess it went through a court system, blah, blah, blah. And in the end, they decided that he didn't steal them because he had purchased the land and they gave it back to him. But anyway, it was a whole drama. And eventually he ended up selling the land to somebody who's actually Mexican. And now it's, of course, in the hands of the Mexican government, and it's a UNESCO heritage site. So, but an interesting beginning with a American gentleman archaeologist going in and just excavating and seeing what kind of treasure he could find. Treasure hunting. Indiana Jones story right there.
Yeah, cenotes are crazy. There's thousands of them on the Yucatan Peninsula.
Yeah.
And all over the place. And basically they're just, they're openings to, I mean, to we have aquifers all over this, all over the United States as well. And a lot of places have aquifers where there's water. And it's basically where the water table is. You know, there's water seeped into the upper crust of the earth all over the planet. In a place where you're largely at sea level the whole time, you have a lot of water that seeps in through the limestone. In fact, when we worked in the site that we met on in Miami, Florida, we were in a place that we called the Well, and it was a place and a source of fresh water for, you know, prehistoric peoples, but also the early Spanish that were there, because the brackish water of the Miami River was right next door, and then the intercoastal waterway was not that far away, but that was all salty. You couldn't drink that. And that water would filter through the limestone and then become drinkable as it filtered through the limestone to filter out all the salt. Well, these cenotes are freshwater cenotes. They're all connected underneath through networks of waterways. The closer you get to the ocean or the Gulf, depending on where you're at, it, it becomes saltier because it's not filtered.
Yeah. They're basically just like sinkholes in the, on the surface that go down to the water table, and they are the main source of water across that area of Mexico. And it's part of the reason why it was such an easy area for the Maya to settle and create monumental architecture, because they had water just so easily accessible right there. So there's at least four cenotes in the immediate vicinity of the ruins, and there's probably many more that we don't know about. And there's actually, this is really interesting, and our guide did tell us about this when we were walking around the site, is that there's a like hidden cenote or a covered or buried. I don't know if that's the right
word. They're all underground.
Yeah.
It just doesn't have an opening.
Yeah. But I guess they think that the Mayan people knew about this cenote because it's underneath the main pyramid, the pyramid of Kokolkan. And they just discovered it in 2015 that it was even there.
Yeah. So, I mean, of course, we don't have a deep knowledge of this, and we don't know what they were thinking when they put this temple there, or this entire settlement, really. That being said, there are thousands of cenotes. Like, you'd have to try hard not to put a temple over a cenote.
Yeah, so it could have been a total accident.
Yeah, did they know it was way down there? Maybe, maybe not, but what's the difference?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He made it sound like it was this big deal that, oh, you know, they had more knowledge of the surrounding area. And they did. I'm sure there's every chance that they possibly knew about it. Right. But what would benefit them from putting a massive stone structure over a thin limestone crust that could collapse into the water? I mean, I kind of would have wanted to put one somewhere where there wasn't a cenote underneath there.
Yeah.
You know, and I wonder if they're called cenotes when they don't have an opening, if it's just like an underground aquifer, but becomes a cenote when it's got the opening. Into a sinkhole.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. Yeah. I don't know about the geology of that.
Probably if we knew what the word cenote meant in Spanish.
I don't know. I didn't I didn't look that up. Yeah. I just know it means, well, it means sinkhole, I think. But
So that makes sense.
Yeah. But getting back to like the structures themselves at Chichen Itza, it is a complex of structures. We've kind of hinted at here. There's the largest one, which is the one that you see in all the images. It's the one that you and I posted on Instagram when we were there. It's the step pyramid of Kokolkan. And Kokolkan is a snake god, like a feathered snake god. And on the pyramid itself, down near the base, there's like the head of a snake. And this is where you also get the shadows across the side of the pyramid, create like a ridged image that looks like the snake body, like flowing down the side of the structure at the equinoxes. And then one interesting thing to note about that is everybody wants to tell you that this only happens on the equinox, but just keep in mind that the sun will be in the position to create this snake image for several weeks on either side of the equinoxes. And the
pretty low resolution.
So like, yes, it is cool that they did build this in a specific way to create that and make that happen. But like, I don't really think they were using it as a way to know when the exact dates of the equinox were and stuff like that.
I mean, if you've ever played Minecraft, it's kind of like an intentional 8-bit video game. And like, pretty much all the Mayan structures are like 8-bit Minecraft structures.
Yeah, they kind of are with that geometric like shape.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they're not very high resolution. Yeah. They're a little bit fuzzy when you look at them like that.
Yeah.
I don't know if we know exactly for sure. There's a lot of things that seem to line up with this pyramid, but even if they really, truly, intentionally did that, it wouldn't have been exact. Like you said,
no,
it's just too with shadows and with the pyramid and the sun. And, I mean, you would have had to have had something that was, I don't know, way more exacting, even like early sundials. You make a sundial now today, it's not going to be super
exact. It's not perfect.
You're going to know what hour it is, maybe what 10 or 15 minute chunk of time it is. But depending on the thickness of your rod in the middle and the resolution of your clock around the edge, you know, that's going to determine what exact time it is.
Yeah.
You know, and then you have to know exact time of day. And there's just so many factors in it. So,
and I don't mean to like to say that they weren't like super smart and intelligent with their knowledge of the sun and the way it moved and stuff like that. They clearly were. But I almost feel like it does a disservice to their knowledge to try to say that they built this temple to let them know when the equinox was. Please, these people knew when the equinox, they didn't need some shadow on a temple to tell them when the equinox is happening. Like they definitely knew when that was going on.
Exactly.
So,
it's probably more like they built it to demonstrate their knowledge of when the equinox is to the people around it. Because you know, religion for a really long time, and religion has always been tied to like monarchy and power and things like that. They get their power from having knowledge of astronomical events.
Yeah. And displaying it.
And displaying that power. Because the average person's like, how did they know? You know, because they don't study that.
Yeah.
They don't have that knowledge and that power. And so by building this thing that says, look at this magic snake we made on this certain day of the year, that is pretty crazy for people that don't understand it.
Yeah, that's true. It probably was a way to like just show just a power show, a power.
Yeah.
Power display.
I don't think we could ever prove this, but I have no doubt that when societies start to collapse, it's when people start to figure that kind of stuff out. And the power center collapses and everybody just kind of fades into the jungle because now they all have the same knowledge.
Yeah.
Somebody figures it out, tells everybody else and said, these guys are all a sham. They're just humans that did a thing and they're keeping this from us.
Mm-hmm.
And then when that starts to happen, you have revolution and collapse.
Mm-hmm.
So...
so in addition to the Kukulkan temple, we have also the Temple of the Warriors, the Great Ball Court, there's a skull platform, and many, many more structures. And I would say, given our experience there, you will spend no time learning about those other things. If you're on a tour like we were, and maybe we can get into how our tour experience was specifically.
Yeah, in the next segment.
Yeah, but... I didn't feel like we got to talk about any of those other structures, really. We spent a lot of time looking at the main period and then sort of quickly moved through everything else.
Mm-hmm.
So now Chichen Itza is a little bit interesting because it is a mix of different architectural styles. And we mentioned in the previous segment that was a little bit because we had people moving from Belize and Guatemala up north as those centers of power had collapsed in the south. They moved north and they brought these different architectural styles with them and it became this mix. But additionally, we also have some central Mexico styles that sort of come into play. And there's a city called Teotihuacan, which is over by Mexico City in central Mexico. And it was at this time a really, really large, complex area. They also had large, complex temples and stuff going on over there. You know what they weren't? Mayan.
Yeah.
They were not Mayan. And I think this is something that gets overlooked a lot because everybody's heard, you know, a lot of people have heard of Teotihuacan. And I just kind of assumed, oh, it was either Mayan, it was Aztec. It was one of those because those were the two main ones. Nope, mm-hmm. they were not. They were, their origins are something that are still debated and are a little bit unknown.
Yeah.
When the power collapsed in that area, they sort of became like the Olmec people probably. Hmm. But anyway, so there's some influence from them and they might have been putting pressure on the Maya cities in the area. And that might have been why some of the cities collapsed and people moved to Chichen Itza. So.
All right. Well, we'll end this segment there. And on the other side, we'll talk about some more of the things that we saw there, a little bit of the history and maybe a little bit about the tour itself. We'll dive a little more specifically into the tour and what that was like in case, as a lot of Americans do, you go down to Cancun and you want to come and visit.
Yeah, you should definitely know what you're getting into with those.
Yeah.
So
we'll be back in a second with our final segment to talk about that. All right. Welcome back to episode 118 of the Archaeology Show. And we're talking about our trip to Chichen Itza. And I do have to mention, too, like a noise started between segments on this like hotel room apartment thing that we're in.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I can remove it all and make it still sound good. So there it is.
It is what it is.
Yeah. The joys of podcasting from pretty much anywhere in the world.
Yeah. We should like really investigate a mobile studio somehow.
Well, this is our mobile studio. We have microphones.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah,
that's true.
You can have like a mobile wraparound sound booth to take with you. That would be, I can't fit that in my backpack.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
But it would be kind of cool if we could.
Yeah. You know what else is not mobile? Big stone pyramids.
What?
So we're talking about our experiences at Chichen Itza in the Yucatan Peninsula. And it was, again, quite the experience.
Yeah. So we did book the trip through our resort and we felt safer doing it that way because Mexico is another country and we didn't know like what travel around the country would be like and stuff like that. So,
yeah. And it was specifically booked through a company called Cancun Tours.
Oh,
and
okay.
I actually reviewed them on TripAdvisor because I thought while I would have liked a lot more time in Chichen Itza, I thought the entire day, which we'll mention briefly since this is not a podcast about that, but it's more about Chichen Itza, but it was actually kind of like a whole history day, which was kind of nice. But
yeah.
I thought they did overall a really good job, like wrangling us all together and taking us different places and having us experience like four unique experiences in the course of a single day.
I agree, but it felt a little bit too rushed. Yeah. So here's our day. Let me just lay it out for you so you can know what you're getting into if you book one of these tours, because it seems like they are all very similar. So we had to get up and leave the hotel super early at like 7 a.m. And
which is super early, like resort time.
Well, yeah. I mean, you probably had some drinks the night before. Let's not lie. So
you mean the entire day before.
Right. So you got to be up and ready to go really early. 7 a.m. They pick you up in one of their vans.
Which we almost missed because of their fault.
It was their fault. It's fine. Whatever. We got on the van. And the first stop was to like a Mayan village. But it took like, what, 3 hours to get there? It was a long trip.
Hours to get there, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
So they kind of left us alone for the morning part of the ride, and we just sort of like chilled and had time to read or do whatever in the van. Yeah. But we got to this Mayan village, and right before we got there, we got a whole lecture about how this is the only place that you can buy authentic Mayan goods and to never, ever, ever spend money on anything that you buy in Chichen Itza. And we were like, oh wow, that's like super great. I'm totally into like supporting like true Mayan authentic artifacts, blah, blah, blah. Great. So we get there and like, it's like a hotel that has a store.
It's a little village back there.
Is there? Okay. Well,
I think the people live in the area. This is just where they sell their stuff.
Probably. So yeah. It did feel a little bit better because we bought a couple things and like, it did feel like we were supporting the people that actually lived in that area. Yeah. But it's unclear because it could have been just like a tourist thing that they set up for these tours specifically.
Right.
They did feed us there though. We got lunch. It was a little bit early. It was probably
food was good.
And it was really good. Really good food. So
it was really good.
So from there.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that real quick, because if you're in archaeology and you're listening to this, you'll know all about obsidian. There were people that we were with that had never heard of obsidian before, which kind of blew me away. I mean, I'm sure there was a time when I didn't know about obsidian either, but I also grew up with a grandfather who was kind of a rock hound. So I kind of knew about obsidian from a small child.
I for sure didn't know anything about obsidian.
Yeah.
Like I probably learned about it in school or something, but I didn't understand like what it looked like in real life at all.
Sure, sure. And so they had just a ton of really cool stuff. They did this whole presentation about their Mayan gods and the different shapes and things like that. And what these obsidian talisman, for a lack of a better word, will do. Like, oh, if you want to have great wealth, you buy this one and put it in your house.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And apparently hot rock massages. And I don't know, I've never had one of those, but apparently they're polished obsidian a lot of times.
Oh.
And these people think that the obsidian like focuses energy and whatever. You can decide about that if you want, but
yeah. And here was my thing with this whole experience is that you didn't know what was like geared towards tourists spending money and what was true, legit, like Mayan cultural practices, you know?
Yeah, so stuff wasn't cheap either because this was a small Mayan village. Now we bought these two obsidian discs that are really, they look like coasters.
Yeah.
About the size of a coaster,
and,
right?
And they look like they're like super highly polished and really shiny.
Highly polished, very, probably the purest obsidian I've ever seen in my life.
Really beautiful.
Just like no imperfections, no banding, no anything. And the one reason I wanted to buy one, I bought a plain one with no design on it, was because you can hold it up to the sun and look directly at the sun through it because it's such dark obsidian. There's lighter, more translucent obsidian that you can't do that with. And I've never seen a big enough piece of obsidian to look at the sun.
Yeah.
We often find like a projectile point or something like that, and we hold it up to the sun to see the banding and you know, describe it, but it's never been big enough to just like block the entire sun. But this thing is probably 4 inches across and you can do that. And Rachel bought an identical one, but has like an etched in pattern
like
on
swirly
it.
Pattern. Really yeah.
Now those were $50 a piece.
Yeah. US,
like 1400 Mexican dollars.
Yeah.
Pesos.
And so here's the thing, like our guide was over and over, like really hammering the point that this is the only place to get this authentic stuff. Yeah. And you wouldn't be able to buy it at Chichen Itza. And if you wanted to buy something like this, you really needed to do it at this shop. And okay, great. Like we'll comply with that. Like we did, we bought it there, but I definitely saw like tons and tons and tons of vendors at Chichen Itza itself selling the exact same thing.
Yeah.
Probably cheaper though. I didn't investigate prices too closely. So,
yeah.
So, you know, again, it's hard to know if like that first stop was just a tourist trap made to like funnel our money there instead of at Chichen Itza. I don't know, but here's what did happen though, is when you enter, so the next stop was Chichen Itza, right? After lunch and after this Mayan village, which was really a hotel.
A resort,
sure. With a pool and everything. So
it looked real fancy.
We pull up to Chichen Itza. It's really packed, like super packed. And our guide, and apparently that's not very packed. It looked packed to us, but it's not very packed given the times right now.
When we were ready to get in, we got right in.
Yeah, we did. We did.
Yeah.
So the guide, he hammered home a couple things. Again, like they're very specific about making sure that we knew certain things. And the one at this place was that they only had 90 minutes for the tour. 90 minutes for the tour, no more, no less. We had to be out after 90 minutes. And like they were somehow starting a clock. Well, I don't know about you, but I didn't notice anybody paying any attention to what our tickets said when we went in or how long we were there or who was actually keeping track of this 90-minute clock.
Yeah, well, like I said in a previous segment, nobody took our ticket or noted that we even walked out the front door.
No. So here's the thing, and this is probably going to happen if you do one of these tours. And honestly, I felt safer doing this tour. I'm not sure I would do it differently anyway because I don't speak Spanish very well, and like it felt easier, but 90 minutes is not enough time in Chichen Itza if you're an archaeologist like us and you want to like roam around and look at all of the different structures and all the different temples and everything and take all the pictures and do the things that you want to do. 90 minutes is not enough time because this place is huge and sprawling. And yeah.
And the other big thing is they, I don't want to say required, but basically required us to stay with them during the tour.
Yeah.
There was another couple that was with us that we actually talked to quite a bit. And the woman, she just wasn't having it.
Not into it. It was so funny.
Like 30 minutes. And then at some point when he was rambling on, she's like, listen, can we just go?
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, don't miss the bus. You better be back at the front.
Yeah.
And they hooked up with us a little bit later, but they went off and did their own thing. And I don't know, without having been prepared prior to with like literature and things to know what I'm looking at, I appreciated the first time going through, regardless of whether or not his information was 100% accurate or current, I appreciated having the information and having the person to take us around this first pass.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely agree with that. Having somebody who knows what they're looking at is really nice. I just wish we could have slowed down the pace. We spent a lot of time at the main temple, which is great because that is the most spectacular part of it. But we really just like blew through all of the other structures, and there's like 8-10 other things to see there.
That's a lot of stuff to see there.
A lot, and probably other things that we didn't even stop by at all. So that was my only complaint, is I would have liked more time to just roam. I wish we could have been sent off on our own for half an hour, an hour maybe, and then meet back up at a certain time. That would have been more my speed.
Right. I think 2 hours or 2.5 hours would have been great to just kind of detail what you just said. Basically, do the tour with him, walk around, see stuff, and then, you know, go do our own thing.
Yeah, exactly. And I think we speculated that it's possible that they just didn't have time, because this was only stop 2 of 4 for this tour.
Yes.
So it might be that this 90-minute hard stop deadline that they gave us was because that was the allotted time before we had to get to the next thing.
Right.
So
I don't know. Are we done kind of talking about Chichen Itza? Because the rest of the tour was also somewhat historical and probably interesting to people who are fans of history and archaeology, I kind of want to talk about the rest of it.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, I think we kind of covered everything for Chichen Itza. There's not really much else to say. I definitely recommend, if you're going to Cancun, to visit it for sure. And maybe if you are like us and want to get more archaeology and less of the other stuff, although the other stuff is neat, but if you want more archaeology, maybe look into a tour that spends all day at the site rather than one of the ones like we did where you hop around to different things.
Right.
But it's totally up to you, because I feel like the rest of it was worth it for us as well.
Yeah. And so let's talk about the rest of this, because the next thing that we did was only like 30 minutes from Chichen Itza. And as we mentioned in a previous segment, there are cenotes everywhere, which are basically sinkholes where you can access fresh water.
Yeah.
Some of these are incredibly deep. Some of them have cave structures underwater. Some of them have cave structures above water where you can go in. We saw pictures. There were some tours you could do that were specific cenote tours where you're wearing a life jacket and you're literally inside of a cave floating around this thing, which I don't know how that would have been.
I'm like so into that.
I know.
But
I think I would have done it for sure, but I don't know how it would have been. Let's just put it that way.
But we didn't do that kind.
No, we did the one that was just like on this tour, right? So we didn't know what to expect. But again, they took us to this kind of tourist hub that was like centered around the cenote, but had like a bar
and a restaurant and
like a gift shop and a bunch of other stuff. And it was really kind of tourist heavy. But that being said, because it was like that, they really did everything, I think, really well for, again, a first experience doing all this stuff. When I go to someplace, my first experience, I wouldn't mind it being heavily guided.
Yeah.
Just so I can know
like what to expect.
Yeah. What to do there. So you had to get a life jacket. They had really good, your typical like water skiing style life jackets in lots of sizes, a changing room outside, showers where you could rinse off because they don't want your sunscreen and all that other chemicals into the cenote, which is cool because cenotes, the underground aquifers, I mean, it's the source of water for like all of the peninsula. So, and then you have to go down these steps that are real slippery. They're stone and then wood and steep, and you got to be real careful. And you go all the way down these steps. I think they said it was like 160 steps or something like that, way down to the water level.
And you've got traffic going in both directions. You know what it reminded me of? It reminded me of the steps to some of the waterfalls in Yosemite.
Exactly.
Yeah. Very much like that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When you're trying to go up and down. It's peak time and you're trying to get to this, like you're trying to do this hike.
Yeah.
I say hike in like air quotes because some of those waterfall views, they're right off of like a main road in Yosemite, and it's just loaded with people that don't want to go out
farther. And like somebody wears Old Navy flip flops and like can't handle the steps. Yeah. It's like that.
I'll never forget one of those little aside where we had to go through all that to continue the hike to like the upper falls, which was a much more strenuous hike, and there was nobody up there.
Yeah. Which again, do the thing that other people don't do because it's way better. Anyway.
So anyway, getting down there was cool. You could jump off into the cenote. I've got a thing with my ear that happened back in like high school, and I can't really jump into water without blowing my head up. Mm-hmm. So I didn't do that, and we kind of like walked down the steps. But once you're in the cenote, it's huge. They've got these ropes that you can kind of like hold on to. There's no real current, but if you want to just kind of like chill and hold on to one of the ropes and not move around, you can do that. The water was very refreshing for the 90 plus degrees it was down there.
There was a waterfall at one point of it. Like there's water coming down the top across like... What's the mathematical term for...
Like the drip edge?
Well, like the cenote was a circle and there was like a waterfall.
Like a tangent.
Yeah, like a tangent across one part of it. It was so cool. So we swam under that a little bit.
Yeah.
It was just quite a neat experience for something that you can't... I've never heard of anyway in the United States. So I definitely recommend checking out a cenote if you go to Cancun.
It was really cool.
Yeah.
And we were in there for... I think we had like an hour.
Yeah.
At this place and... We made it out right as we were getting into the bus.
We did.
Because we spent probably, it didn't feel like it, but we must have spent 30 to 35 minutes like just floating in this cenote.
We must have. We had our cameras out and we should definitely, we haven't created a video for this yet, but we will at some point and we'll backlink it to this episode so you guys can watch our video about it because it was so cool.
We recorded some social media type stuff too, but we did it all on the GoPro and not on our phone. So it's kind of locked into the GoPro right now.
Yeah, we haven't downloaded and all that fun stuff. So we'll get there.
Yeah. Anyway, that was all super cool. And when we left the cenote, again, we didn't hang out. We didn't go to if you didn't want to swim, you could like get a drink or something, I guess. But we didn't do any of that.
Yep.
And the next stop was what they said was like a typical Mexican town, which I always forget the name of, Valladolid or Valladolid
or
something. It starts with a V.
It was one of a more difficult Spanish word, and I can't remember what it was either.
But my takeaways from that were it's a typical, like they said, it's a typical Mexican town.
Yep.
And the one cool thing that I didn't know about, there's a Catholic church there.
Oh, yeah. That was a good story.
That apparently like 200 years ago or something, somebody was murdered like in the church.
Right.
And then the Rome, the Vatican, basically, they shut that church down and said, nope, you can't have a church anymore.
Yeah. It's been desecrated. You can't use it anymore.
And a few years later, and I think they demolished it. They demolished the old church.
Oh, did they? Yeah, because full on got rid of it. Okay.
Because when a new, I don't know, new priest or whatever came in and said, I want to build another church here because this town needs a church.
Mm-hmm.
The Vatican's like, yeah, great. But because this ground had somebody killed on it in the church, your church will now face north and not face east. Like apparently Catholic churches always did in the past. I don't know if they still do, but
I don't know. Like, you'd think I would know that, but
downtown,
I don't know.
You know, we're in Philadelphia right now. How can you make it face east? But
well, I suppose you pick your, if it's that important, you pick your property it works. But
yeah. But apparently it faces north because it can no longer face east because it, you know, lives in sin. But there you go.
Well, and with this, the way Mexican towns are set up, and I think this is true across Central South America and probably in Europe too, because a couple places I went in Peru looked exactly like this when we went, but it's like a big square in the middle. There's usually kind of a park atmosphere with benches and trees and grass and all that kind of stuff, a place for people to go and relax, walk their dogs, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So they had that. And then there's all the buildings sort of lining the edge of the square. And the church was one of them. And there just was a bunch of stuff there. It's a bunch of restaurants on one side, a lot of buildings. We went and got some elote, the street corn, which was super yummy.
Delicious.
Yeah, there's churros if you wanted to do it. So anyway, we had about half an hour there to just kind of walk around, experience the center square of the town. And I enjoyed that from a cultural perspective because, first of all, it reminded me of going to Peru. So I saw the similarities, and which is, it's a Spanish influence, right? So like, I totally could see why they had that. And it was just a cool experience to see like, you know, just a normal town where normal people live. And it wasn't, I didn't feel like it was heavily touristy. There was a couple other people around like us, but it wasn't crazy. So that was a cool end to our trip.
Yeah. One final note on that. They were mentioning as we came in that a lot of the older buildings, which were most of them were older buildings, including the church, were built from essentially Mayan ruins.
Oh, yeah. They repurposed the bricks because, you know, why not?
Because there's the
places, not bricks, but stones.
Stones, yeah. The place is littered with Mayan ruins, right?
Yeah.
So back in the day when people were building towns, they would just like dismantle these things and bring them over and use them in construction. So
yeah. Again, reminding me of Peru because you see that fusion of architecture down there so much, particularly in Cusco, which is near where Machu Picchu is. So anyway, super interesting.
So if you're ever down in the area, remember, Cancun is not in the Yucatan Peninsula. It's in the Quintana Roo district. Oh, it's on the Yucatan Peninsula, but the,
yeah,
the like the state is Quintana
Roo.
Yeah. And then you go over to Yucatan.
Which is where Chichen Itza
is. Where Chichen Itza
and
is.
It's like a solid 3-hour drive. So that's why this was a full 12-hour day, is because we had 3 hours of driving on either end of it.
Plus like 2 hours of driving in the middle of it.
So yeah.
There was a lot of driving.
There's a lot of driving.
Yeah, that's why it was a really long day. So yeah. And we had a bus transfer at the beginning and the end.
Yeah.
We kind of picked up people. But anyway.
And if you're tall, watch out, like you.
Oh my God, my feet, my legs were in the seats. My knees were like the entire time.
Yeah, they're not made for tall people.
At least the vans, every vehicle we got in was heavily air conditioned.
Yes.
Yeah, Chichen Itza is going to be super hot too. It was super windy on the whole peninsula that entire week. Mm-hmm. So that was great for us. But if it's not, it's wildly exposed and super hot.
Yes.
But the wind really kept it down. So.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it's a spectacular archaeological site. It's been well preserved and it's definitely worth seeing.
Yeah, absolutely. So check it out. Check out our show notes and we'll see you next time.
Adios.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at arcpodnet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.